9 weeks. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
If you're having trouble getting online today, it may be because you didn't bother to get rid of a malicious software virus the FBI warned about. Cybersecurity expert Stan Stahl says it's been on some people's computers since before last November.
That's when the cybercrime ring was brought down by the FBI.
And the FBI provided a temporary fix, which it has now discontinued. It's not known how many computers may still be infected, but the experts say it's probably in the tens of thousands in the U.S. Stahl says if you cannot download appropriate anti-malware software yourself, you should probably contact your internet service provider for help. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, who values straightforward reporting and straightforward banking. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. On July 12th, jazz legend Lamont Parsons and his collaborators take to the lobby stage. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
Well, if you sat down and started to make a list of people who were important in the history of baseball, most of the people on that list are going to be players. And certainly there will be some managers that will appear on that list. Owners, well, not so many. But in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about someone who was indeed an owner, who has had a very profound impact on the game, and certainly is someone who is remembered as being one of baseball's most eccentric personalities. And the guy that we're talking about is Bill Veeck. Certainly many people will remember him for all of the wacky things that he did to try to get people to come out to the ballpark. But this one-time owner of the Chicago White Sox did indeed have a serious impact on the game. He introduced some innovations that we now take for granted, and he was also an early advocate for the inclusion of black players. Our guest for this hour of Focus is the author of a recently published biography of Veeck. The title of the book is Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. Walker is the publisher, and the author is our guest, Paul Dixon. He's the author of a number of books about baseball, including The Dixon Baseball Dictionary, The Unwritten Rules of Baseball, The Hidden Language of Baseball, and The Joy of Keeping Score. And he's written a number of other books as well. So if you're interested in sports, certainly if you're interested in baseball, you can take a look at those. And we'll talk this morning about Bill Veeck and Paul Dixon. Hello.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Well, I knew a little bit about Veeck. I certainly have appreciated the opportunity to learn more about him. And I guess the thing that I would say sort of overall is, while he was somebody who, I'm sure he wanted to win as much as anybody, and he wasn't opposed to making money, but it certainly seems that he was someone whose heart was with the fans, and what he wanted was for people who came to the games to have a good time.
Yeah, no, I think that's the key to it. I think he changed it, and that's one of the most profound ways he changed it, because when Veeck died, Hank Greenberg, the famous Detroit Tiger slugger, who was very close to Veeck, he said, you know, before Veeck, it was win or lose. Veeck, all of a sudden, Veeck came along, and it was fun to go to the ballpark. That was part of what he was selling, and his dedication to the fan was just unbelievable. He also was like his father, who actually was the president of the Chicago Cubs. Many people don't know that, but Veeck was born into a life of baseball. But both father and son had this tremendous desire to bring women into the ballparks. Before the Veecks came along, it was pretty much an all male crew. You see those old pictures of the guys with the straw hats and the ties and such. You very, very, very seldom saw a female face or a child in the ballpark, even in the bleachers. And Veeck Sr. started with the ladies' days. In fact, Veeck's father was the first one to promote a woman to a front office position. Then Bill came along, and Bill, every time he took over a ballpark, starting with the Milwaukee Brewers, the minor league Brewers in 1941, he would rip out the old ladies' rooms or the old powder rooms, whatever they call them, and totally redo them. You know, take out the fluorescent lights and spruce them up and make them nice. And then he would go to elaborate ends to get women to the ballpark, because he felt that women came and then the kids came and then you had the whole family, and you're basically marketing now not to individuals anymore, but family units. And I think, you know, one of the benefits of that is, you know, the Los Angeles Dodgers just sold for $2 billion with a B dollars. And I think part of that is the reason the team is worth that much is, it's insane to me, but part of the reason somebody's willing to pay that much is because Bill Veeck increased the fan base, and he also did it with minorities. He really made a tremendous effort to get people of color and other minorities to the ballpark.
Yeah. You know, I think almost every review that I read of the book used the same phrase, and they talked about him being born into the game. And as you mentioned, his dad worked for the Cubs. And what's interesting is apparently his father had been a sports writer and had written a lot of things about the management of the Cubs being incompetent. And when the Wrigleys came along, they said to him, "So you think you can do better?" And I guess he said something like, "Well, I couldn't do much worse." And so they hired him to run the team. And then Bill Jr. Grew up doing things around the ballpark.
In fact, his father, I think one of the things I strongly suggest in the book is one of the reasons the other reason the Wrigleys brought him in as Veeck Sr., Bill Sr., was that he saw something wrong with the 1918 World Series. Now, that was the one that was the Boston Red Sox with Babe Ruth versus the Cubs. And in his columns, he suggests that something was radically wrong in the game at that point. And he later goes on in 1920 and Veeck Sr. blows the whistle on gamblers who are trying to infiltrate the ball clubs and get guys to throw games. And his sort of due diligence on this whole issue of corruption and fixing sets off the whole investigation into the infamous Chicago Black Sox, the 1919 team. Mm. So, in effect, he was a baseball reformer as well as a true progressive. He advocated, his father advocated things like interleague play. So it's crazy to have two ball clubs in Chicago and they only meet each other once every 20 years or something in the World Series, or 40 years, that they never play. And it's natural. Or New York at that time had three clubs, if you count Brooklyn. And he says it's crazy for them not to play during the season. And so, you know, it's he had a lot of those. And when he dies in 33, dies unexpectedly, Bill Sr., has leukemia. And he dies in 33, and then Bill comes in, quits college. Bill has been at Kenyon College, quits college, and comes to work for the Cubs. And the first job he gets with the Cubs, the Wrigley asks him to go start hanging out in the stands and finding out what the fans really want. Because Wrigley understood marketing and publicity, because he was in the chewing gum business, and he had to appeal to a large number of people. So in a funny way, he brought some of that modern thinking to baseball, that you really want to sell the whole idea of going to the ballpark, not just going because your team may win or lose.
Mm-hmm.
And Veeck gets into, by 1937, Veeck gets into the business of redesigning the park under Wrigley. Wrigley said, let's fix this place up. And he's the one in charge of planting the ivy. And if you walk into Wrigley Field today, I was there a week ago today, I was at Wrigley, and you walk in through those portals and you look out of that outfield, and all that stuff has been modified. But the scoreboard, the configuration of the bleachers, the groundskeepers, there's a place on the left field where the groundskeepers keep all their stuff. It's sort of hidden in the wall, but all that stuff was pretty much put there. Well, was put there by Veeck, including the light signal that tells people in the elevator as they're coming home whether the, you know, if the light's green, the Cubs have won. If the light's red, the Cubs have lost. So that somebody whizzing by on the train can determine who won and lost.
Mm. We are talking, maybe I should just real quick introduce again our guest here. We're talking with Paul Dixon. He's the author of a recently published biography of Bill Veeck. The title of the book is Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. And Veeck was certainly famous for things that he did to try to popularize the game, to get people out, to make it more family friendly. He was a champion of black players, having black players in the major leagues. And over his time, did own several baseball teams, probably people around these parts will think of the time that he was the owner of the Sox, the White Sox, Chicago White Sox, but he also owned teams in Cleveland and in Milwaukee and in St. Louis, and we'll continue to talk 1-800-333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, after his dad died, he continued to work for the Cubs, but he apparently really wanted to have his own team. He wanted to run his own team, and so he and a partner bought the Milwaukee Brewers, which at the time, and it's not the team that exists today. This was a minor league team, and apparently the team was pretty much a wreck when he bought it.
Yeah, and the team in the stadium was falling down, and it was a bargain sale. I mean, they bought it for almost nothing. They had a few backers, but they had he and Charlie Grimm, who had actually been the manager of the Cubs at one point, take over the team. And you know, they immediately start changing things. They immediately start having these wacky promotions. Nobody's ever seen anything like it before in baseball. They to get people to come to this stadium. I think the first night they go there, there are 11 people in the stands. He and Charlie Grimm, they said, "We got to do something fast." And Vec has these unbelievable giveaways. He gives away livestock. He gives away braces of pigeons. He advertises one night that the lucky fan will get 100 silver dollars. And, of course, the fan wins the 100 silver dollars, and he gets the silver dollars are frozen in this immense block of ice, so this poor guy has to stay there half the night before he can get his money out of the big block of ice. But he's he's doing wild stuff. I mean, he's changing baseball because at one point he realizes that in Milwaukee, that Milwaukee is heavily industrialized for World War II. This is 1942, and there are three shifts going, you know, all the time. There's guys working, men, women working. And so he gets this idea he's going to start having some games at 9 o'clock in the morning to fulfill the needs of the night shift, the midnight to 7 a.m. or whatever, 8 a.m. shift, so that when they come off work, they can come out to the ball game and see a baseball game. And, of course, you know, he does it all up grand. He has Charlie Grimm, you know, lying in a four-poster bed, brass bed, and Vec comes out. All the officials of the team come out with bowls of Wheaties and cornflakes and give them to people as they come in, and he hands it up. But this immediately gets some of the other ball clubs very upset because he's breaking with tradition. You can't have a game at 8 o'clock in the morning. But it also gets the attention of the national media. He said, "Oh, this guy's really doing something for the war effort. That third shift is—he's now the hero of the third shift all over the country." And Vec starts to get really high level of publicity in this little rinky-dink team in Milwaukee. Then rinky-dink, you know. And in those days, he gets featured in Look magazine and Collier's, Saturday Evening Post. In those days, this was the equivalent of getting on, I don't know what today, but you know, every major network or something. It was just getting this huge publicity, and he started to change baseball in Milwaukee just with this whole attitude he had about the fans. And one of the things he did is a famous picture of him in the Look magazine, where he always sat in the bleachers. He always felt that the knowledge of baseball was inversely proportional to the amount of money you paid for the ticket. So he used to like to sit in the bleachers. And I asked Andy McPhail, who was famous baseball family, and I asked him, you know, Vec had really crossed swords with the other owners in his various ownerships. And I asked Andy McPhail, why did the other owners hate Vec so much? And he said, well, there are a lot of reasons, but he said what really got under their skin was that Vec, until his dying, I mean, right before he died, would go to always sit in the cheap seats, and he loved it. And the other owners, he would own a world championship team, which he owned in Cleveland, and he would still sit in the bleachers. And the other owners found this just all unbelievable that the owner would do that. They were corporate, and they were aloof, and they wore double-breasted suits, and they just weren't him.
Yeah.
Different.
So we're come to he does this in Milwaukee. He is very successful in increasing attendance. He gets this national attention, and it's World War II, and he enlists in the Marines. And the Marines apparently were very happy because he was a famous guy, and they figured, well, they could use him to recruit. And Vec said, no, I want to fight, and was sent out to fight, and of course was injured, and that ended up. That injury and its consequences ended up being a part of his life for the rest of his life.
Yeah. He goes through six. You lose count of them, but he goes through 16 major amputations, and the amputations are such that they affect. There's infection, and that affects his hearing, and he's he's a wreck. I mean, when he writes his biography, Vec is in wreck. He's alluding to his own physical shape. He wrote that book 50 years ago at a time he thought he probably wouldn't last through the rest of the year. He was that sick. But he does, he goes, he demands to go to combat. I mean, it's not only just demands not to do, he says, I don't want to be a recruiter. I don't want to tell somebody to go out there and die. I said, that's my decision. That's not me. And he got out. I've actually found his sergeant, a Marine Corps, the sergeant that was in charge of him in the South Pacific. He said, it was unbelievable. He would get up there on the, he never swore, but he would get up in these battlements. The Japanese lines were 350, 400 yards away. There was live ammunition. And he'd get up there and hurl invective at the enemy at night. And he would, then strange things would happen. They'd be right in a combat zone. I mean, there's anti-aircraft fire and there's strafing and everything else. And all of a sudden, one day, the sergeant, who's now in a nursing home, says to me, he said, you know, I never could figure out one thing. I said, what's that? He said, well, one day this plane lands, and out of the plane comes bats and balls and gloves, all this baseball equipment. He said, somehow Vec got this, all this equipment sent into this combat zone. So he does, you know, he suffers immensely. He's all of his life is a matter of suffering. Yet he almost uses, and he's going through, he can't even, the early prostheses don't work, and they're just too painful. And at one point in his life, he converts to an old-fashioned wooden peg leg, which most of his later years he uses. But he even this he makes light of. He builds an ashtray into the wooden leg so that when he's, especially he's in negotiation, and there's where people smoked in meetings, and he'll just pull up his pant leg and then start sniffing out the ashes in his leg. And one of his kids told me that when he, at one point in his life, when Bill Vec was living on the eastern shore of Maryland, he, as the summer progressed, he had all these different deck paints out in the shed, and he would paint his wooden leg so it looked like he's getting a deeper tan as the summer went on.
Well, so he goes through all of this, and also at the same time that he's dealing with this and he's dealing with the war and being with the Marines, he's still running the team.
He's trading people from a combat zone. And I was once at a meeting of baseball scholars, and they said, oh, this couldn't be. There's no way he could do it. And I actually went back and found the records where he was using war correspondents to help run the team from the South Pacific. And it was a real combat zone. It was no... You know, there were a lot of guys who died in his within his unit and within the units he was larger unit he was with. And of course, that's one thing there are two real discussions besides baseball. I mean, baseball is really important. It's about a baseball guy, but the two things that really come out are race, and we can talk about that in a second.
Sure.
But the other is, there is this communality between these guys who go out and fight and get hurt. I mean, we've got, during World War II, there's a really interesting communality. And I interviewed Monty Irvin, the great African-American Hall of Famer who played for the Giants. I interviewed him there. He was very close to Vec. And he said, you know, he told me that those guys just had this immense respect for each other. They didn't talk about it. But Irvin said, you know, and he said, you know, Yogi Berra was on the second day of the D-Day invasion, and I was on the 11th, on the 7th day. I mean, the other two guys, you never hear about that when they talk about them. And in my book, I have, there's one game between two pitchers, one guy named Gene Bearden and the other guy named, comes back to me in a second. But they had both been wounded in the war. Lou Brissy is the other pitcher. And Bearden had the back of his head blown out. And literally, he was wearing a plate in the back of his head, and Brissy had part of his leg was mechanical prosthesis. And these guys, there was a toughness, there was a resilience to these guys that I still marvel at, that they could go back, they could come back wounded. And while this game is going on with these two, with Brissy and Bearden are pitching, Vec having his second amputation,
yeah.
And there are other guys on the field who have been in combat, and it was something I really wanted to write about, was because my uncles and my, you know, growing up, those were the people I admired, the greatest generations.
Well, let's go on and talk about race, because, as you say, that's an important part of the story. And you talked a little earlier about how his dad, Bill Sr., And he both were interested in bringing black folks into the stands. And I think at one point his dad said to him famously, he said, you know, it doesn't matter what color you are, everybody's money is the same color. Right. It's all green. So he had that very pragmatic sort of attitude. And Bill Jr. Apparently had long felt that there was a lot of talent in the Negro Leagues. And he had this idea, what he wanted to do after the war was to buy the Phillies, Philadelphia Phillies, and hire all black players. And I know this, there's some controversy about this. I think some people say, oh, no, that he said he wanted to do that. But that was just something that he made up. And you apparently feel that there's enough documentation on this to say, no, that really was his intention. That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah. And actually, what happened, it was actually before he went to combat that this happened. He's already playing around with flashback for a minute to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee. He and Abe Saperstein, who he is very close to, who owns the Harlem Globetrotters, which at that time was not as much of a stunt team as a straight basketball team. And they're already promoting interracial black versus white games in the winter of 41-42. They're promoting games in Milwaukee, the black teams versus white teams. There's some early migration from the black teams to the white teams. And this is all the precursor to the National Basketball Association. You don't hear much about it, but everybody always talks about the integration of baseball. But basketball was integrated during the war, clearly. And he gets involved in with Saperstein, and they get this idea that they find out in the 42 World Series that the Philadelphia Phillies, which are in terrible shape, they can't make payroll, are for sale, and he makes a deal to buy them. He goes back to Chicago to get all his financing in order. He talks to the commissioner of baseball, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, and he talks to a couple journalists who, and he goes tells his family what's up. He talks to his sister, and then he goes back to Philadelphia on the 20th Century Limited. He gets off the train, and he's told that the league is going to buy the team. He's not going to be allowed to do this. Nobody's ever said no. They just said it's not going to happen. He's going to be given this. The league will take over the team. He can't have it. And what happens is his plan was, he and Saperstein, their plan was to get all of these, Satchel Paige and Cool Papa Bell and Josh Gibson and Oscar Charleston, all the great ball players on this team, because they were all, most of these great African-American ball players were older and were exempt from the draft. And Paige was already in his 40s, or just early in his 40s. And so what happened was, and of course this team would have been taken everybody else apart, his father had actually, there had actually been an idea on the floor by a man named Pollock, who was the New York Cubans. There was a plan earlier to put, that was, that his father looked at in 1928, and I'm sorry, 1932, to do this, to have a black team in each league. And people like Babe Ruth actually thought it would be a great idea. There's actually documentation that Ruth looked at this idea, and he said, you know, we're always compared to these. You know, you say I'm the greatest slugger, but I've never been able to play against these other guys, these Negro players. He said, they may be, you know, no one will ever know if I'm the greatest slugger. And other pitchers would say, no one will ever know if I'm the greatest. Walter Johnson, the great right-handed pitcher. So Vec does this. He's thwarted. When he gets to the Cleveland Indians, he's determined to bring on a black player. And then winter of 46-47, he tries to bring in Roy Dandridge, who's playing in Mexico. Dandridge can't afford to leave Mexico. He's being paid so much to pitch down there. The winter before Jackie Robinson is hired by the brought up with the Brooklyn Dodgers by Branch Rickey, Vec actually puts in a black African-American PR guy for the Indians so he can set it up. He knows it's going to be disruptive in the sense there's going to be some resistance. So he gets a guy who's very well known, who is actually Lena Horne's husband, who is a PR man, and he comes in to get everybody ready for Larry Doby. And then 11 weeks after, he brings in Jackie Robinson comes up, Larry Doby comes up. And the kicker is the next year, 48, he brings in Satchel Paige, which really gets the other owners angry because they've been saying for years that the black players aren't up to the ability of the white players. And they're just not competitive. They don't take baseball seriously. Well, they know if they bring up a Paige as an old man and he can beat everybody, then all that they've been saying for years is a lie. And, of course, Paige comes up, helps him win the World Series, World Championship, and becomes a real, real draw for every team he plays against. The next year, just to put a cap on it, the next year, Vec brings up 14 in 49. He brings up 14 black players into spring training, including Minnie Minosa, who's considered the Latin Jackie Robinson, and Luke Easter and Paige and Dobie and some guys you never heard of again. But what Vec had done was he had brought up more African Americans than both leagues put together. Then he chastised everybody who would not integrate for a decade. And that would be he really went after the New York Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, and the Detroit Tigers. They just weren't going to. They just dug in their heels on this issue.
Yeah. Well, let's take a caller here. We have somebody who is ready to go. Others are certainly welcome. Our guest, by the way, is Paul Dixon, and we're talking about his new biography of Bill Vec. And the title of the book is Bill Vec, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. We have somebody on a cell phone here on our line 4, so let's go there. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Great topic. Really enjoying the conversation. I'm joining it late, so you'll forgive me if what I comment on you've already covered and just disregard it, but it's a great topic for a late spring Friday afternoon. Brings back a lot of memories. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, a little west of the actual ballpark, which I think originally, if I remember my history correctly, was actually a cow pasture way back in the day. But I can remember Old Man Daly sending off the alarm sirens when the White Sox won in 59, and that was a big deal. I think the Old Man Daly, the mayor, was a huge White Sox fan. But I do remember stories about Bill Vec, and I don't know, they're great stories. I don't know if they're true, but something about his wooden leg, and he had it carved out, kept a bottle of booze in there, and kind of fantastic. I don't know if there's any truth to it, but
He did have an ashtray in there.
Okay. All right. Very, very good. And the stories about the black players. I can remember my father. He passed away some years ago. He died in 92, but he said he actually remembers seeing Satchel Paige pitch, and he just thought it was a big disgrace that professional baseball brought somebody special like Paige along so late, because he said when he was in his prime, you couldn't touch him. He was the best he's ever seen. But throwing that out there, I know Bill Vec with planting the ivy at Wrigley Field. He was a great showman. He did a lot of good for the industry. So I don't think we'll ever see his likes again. The industry's changed, the moneyed interests. But there was a man who was a true lover of the game. I'll leave that out there for you. Enjoying the conversation.
Okay, well, thanks.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. It's interesting. Somebody asked me the other day, how did Vec leave baseball? And I said, I think if you needed like one phrase, he left baseball with a smile on its face. And maybe that's his legacy.
In this hour of focus, our guest is Paul Dixon. He's the author of a number of books, and several of them are about baseball, including the Dixon Baseball Dictionary and the Unwritten Rules of Baseball. His new book is a biography of Bill Vec. It's titled Bill Vec, Baseball's Greatest Maverick, and Walker is the publisher. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just before talking some more about Vec, I'm sure when you talk, people bring up the question of Larry Doby and why he isn't better known. Even people that don't know anything about baseball know who Jackie Robinson was. Well, I don't know how many people know who Larry Doby was, and he was, so Jackie Robinson was the first guy, but Larry Doby was the second. And
I'm glad you brought it up because, he was accepted the Hall of Fame late. In fact, there's a postage stamp finally coming out with his picture on it this summer from the Postal Service. But Doby was an extraordinary man. He had many more difficult times than Robinson. Robinson had come up having experienced race hatred. Dobie was in a far different case. Dobie had grown up in a very well-to-do New Jersey suburb. He'd gone to high school with Frank Lautenberg, the senator. He'd played baseball against, football against Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut, which is an interesting parallel. The number two, they're both number two. One guy was number two on the moon, and one guy was the second African-American in baseball. But he grew up in an environment that where the race hatred was not part of the diet, and he went to Long Island University, where he played basketball on a predominantly white team, and he was in the segregated military. But he was it was segregated, but there was no hatred involved. He played a lot of baseball against Mickey Vernon, a lot of future major leaguers. He knew a lot of people who were both races, who were involved in black baseball. He and Vernon became lifelong friends. But it's not until he gets into baseball that he starts hearing the N-word. He goes to Griffith Stadium in Washington. He tells a newspaper guy, Wendell Smith, that night, he said, they yelled that word at me so many times I thought my middle name start with the letter N. He plays a game in Houston, an exhibition game as a Cleveland Indian, and as playing first base, and they throw rocks at him, and he has to leave the field, and he just can't comprehend that people in baseball, people fans who pay to go to see him in a baseball game, treat him this way just because he has a different color, and it's remarkable because Beck himself is up to this. He's up to the. There are 20,000 letters written to him, experiencing people writing to him in Cleveland when he brings Dobie up. 20,000 letters of people upset with Beck because he's brought an African American onto the field. Letters of hatred. The one kind that are scribbled on it. You can see almost the anger in the handwriting. And one time I said, "Gee, that's an awful lot of letters." But I found a man who was now in his 80s, who was a reporter on the Cleveland Press, and he said he was a Cub reporter on the sports desk, and he said he would he sat there night after night and listened to these calls that come into the newspaper expressing this real hatred of Dobie being on the team, and it was very difficult, and part of it was even the reason that didn't get more publicity is the papers pretty much decided that it was something they weren't going to report. They're going to try to see if this would play out. And of course Beck is the one guy who's on top of this, who can deal with it, is not afraid of being criticized, is not afraid of being thought of as somebody who's sort of exacerbating racial tensions by putting a black man on a team. I think in a funny way it's the struggle, the struggle of the black players. I interviewed a lot of the older players for this, like Monty Irvin and others. Interviewed Larry Doby's son, and it was pretty remarkable what these guys went through, and the fact that they were of a temperament. They didn't let it. I think Dobie became quite depressed at times, and Beck's response when he got really depressed was he'd take him to an Ella Fitzgerald or a Miles Davis concert, because the two of them had this real great love of jazz in common. But it's part of the American story, and I think, you mentioned a while ago, some people have doubted whether Beck actually tried to buy the Phillies in 42, and I spent a lot of time on it. I went through a lot of material and oral histories and documentation, and I have a whole appendix in the book, which I think I pretty much proved beyond any doubt that it was actually true. The people, the doubters, I think, they couldn't find the paperwork, but, back in 1942, an informal offer, guy trying to, there wasn't a lot of paperwork. It was pretty much of a people talking to each other. But I found enough witnesses and people are involved to suggest it was pretty proved to me, at least, that it was entirely true.
Yeah. So after, he was in Cleveland for a couple of years. Then he sold his stake in the team, and then in 1951, I believe, he comes to St. Louis. And buys into the Browns, which was definitely the B team in town behind the Cardinals, and would later move to Baltimore and changed their name to the Orioles. So here again, he was moving in to a team that was not in great shape, was trying to build it up, trying to get people to come to the games. And here this was the scene of what may be his most famous stunt involving an unconventional player that he set out to bat.
Beck was an unbelievably astute reader. He read as many as 5 books a week. He had read a New Yorker short story by James Thurber about a team that had hired a midget to play for the team, a man under 4 feet, I think, in the original story. And every time the team needed a runner on base, the midget would come to bat and then crouch down so that his batting zone was non-existent, and of course get an automatic walk. And Beck then decides to do the same thing in St. Louis. The rap against the Browns was they couldn't get anybody on base, and he finds a man who plays a midget for a living. He's an actor named Eddie Goodell, who is totally up for this. He's ready to do it. He's in on the gag. And on the second game of a doubleheader, Goodell comes to the plate, crouches, goes to first, is immediately replaced by a pinch runner. The whole of baseball just reacts negatively. They're furious. They now ban people of a certain height from the game. Vec then comes back and says, well, why don't they ban? There was a player named Walt Dropo, who was 6'9". He said, why? They should ban him because he's a giant. And Beck was just having a heyday with this. Goodell goes on all the television shows and becomes sort of a momentary celebrity. And Beck, for all of the rest of baseball getting mad about this whole thing, is Beck actually became, it sort of was a part of getting baseball into the television age. I mean, baseball was losing patrons at that point. Television was getting better, more and more evening shows that were people stayed home for. And by the Beck thing was visually, it was in every paper in the English-speaking world, that picture of him, and that sort of helped bring baseball sort of back into prominence. And he did other stunts there that were pretty crazy. He had one called a Grandstand Manager Night, where the people in the grandstand actually got to hold up placards saying yes or no, and like, should we change pitchers? And they'd all say yes, and they changed the pitcher. And you know, and again, the old guard was just horribly insensitive. The other thing was, even starting with the Indians earlier, he had started demanding things like television revenue sharing and got into a big battle with the New York Yankees about television revenue sharing. Now, this is an issue, if you follow baseball still hasn't figured this one out. But he was really for that early on, that the teams have some kind of parity in terms of revenue sharing.
Yeah. So he apparently wanted to take the Browns to Baltimore. They eventually did go. But why was not he able to engineer that?
They were really getting madder and madder, and he was doing things like, he had been long opposed to the reserve clause, which bound a player to a team as long as the team wanted the player. And he had, even as a young man, he'd written to the commissioner of baseball to say that this was an immoral thing and an illegal thing. And he was shaking them up on every count. He was holding their feet to the fire on race. He was holding their feet to the fire on revenue sharing. He was claiming the other owners were troglodytes who didn't know how to promote baseball. He was embarrassing them on grounds that would prove to be legitimate. He was advocating things like interleague play. He was just all sorts of things that were sort of what he thought was the right thing. And to top it all off, he really didn't care about the antitrust exemption. He really thought that was somehow crazy, that one sport should have this one be exempt from antitrust and all the others not. And the other owners just held on to this for dear life. And Beck just he didn't see why baseball was given this congressional mandate that no other activity. I mean, ballet did not have an antitrust exemption, or as he said, you know, he named all these things. Opera doesn't have an antitrust exemption. Why should baseball?
We're At the point where we have maybe about 12, 14 minutes left, I just want to introduce again the guest, Paul Dixon. He's the author of a number of books, and several of them are about baseball. We're talking here this morning about his new biography of Bill Veeck. The title is Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick, and it's published by Walker. And again, questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, from St. Louis, he goes back to Chicago, where he had grown up, and he and some other people bought the White Sox. And there, it looks like he did kind of what he had done before. Certainly, it was great for attendance. He managed to get more people to come out to the park. And, in fact, the White Sox went on to win their first pennant in four decades. So he had to be doing something right.
He was. And you know, the one really quick little footnote in between the Browns and the White Sox, he also works for the National League to get the West Coast ready for baseball. And he prepares in a four-year period. He gets Los Angeles and San Francisco ready for the National League, and the American League ends up with Oakland and Anaheim, which are fine cities, but they basically, Veeck was able to set up the West Coast for the National League and dominance of the National League. In terms of his first time he owned the White Sox, you know, he really brought life back. I mean, Harry Carey was singing, and you know, he put together a great team, and he really knew what he was up to, and he just, during that period, he just got sicker and sicker and was finally forced to sell the team after he had a visit to the Mayo Clinic, and they pretty much told him he probably was dying. They thought he had a brain tumor of some sort, but they said he would probably be dead. And he then goes to the Eastern Shore of Maryland. After selling the White Sox, he goes to the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where he's going to set up his family and try to recover or die, and he survived.
Yeah, and that's amazing. He after all of that, having been told he was going to die, maybe thinking he was going to die, selling the team, he somehow manages to turn things around and then goes back a second time to the Sox.
Yeah, and this time they're even angry at him because in between he has testified in Kurt Flood's trial. He's basically said, we've got to get away with the reserve clause. And, of course, when he gets the Sox again, the reason he gets the Sox the second time, and you know, I was just in Chicago and we were discussing this with a lot of people, the reason they didn't want him back the second time. They just didn't want him. But the White Sox were headed to Seattle at that point. And Veeck's the only guy who stepped up and said, look, let me buy this White Sox and I'll keep him in Chicago. And that was the key thing, was he was going to keep him there. And so he comes back, he saves the Sox, he's got the team, and now free agency is in fact. So the very thing he's fought for all of his baseball life is now come around to bite him, because now he doesn't have any money, and he's got to go through these wild schemes called rent-a-player and things like that, where picks up guys in the last months of their contract. But he does an admirable job for a guy with not that many resources, but he does come back. He comes up with a lot of great ideas. You know, he puts the players' names on the back of uniforms, which upsets some of the other teams. And, of course, one of the first guys whose name he puts on is Ted Gluszewski, and he misspells his name on purpose to get more publicity from the naming of the thing. And, you know, he starts the whole thing with, you know, Harry Carey singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and he brings a whole new breath of life to baseball in Chicago.
Yeah. Now this also his second time with the Sox, though, this was also the time of the probably the most infamous event in the way of a publicity that he was ever involved with. Something that maybe not his idea, was his son's idea. This was the famous destruction of the disco records.
Yeah, Disco Demolition Night, which was just
a total. It was like a near riot.
Well, it was dangerous, and I was one of the last interviews I did for it was with Ernie Harwell, who just before he died we interviewed, and Ernie was up at the booth because they were playing the Detroit Tigers that night, and Harwell said he'd never seen anything like it. The people setting fires all over the stadium, and they were. There was huge amounts of liquor consumed, and even huger amounts of marijuana consumed. And he said there was a cloud of marijuana smoke over the stadium, and it was the wrong crowd. It was a crowd of you know, that was disruptive, and they would throw these records that they were going to blow up during the between the halves of a doubleheader, where people were throwing them off the upper deck. They were coming down like, you know, like evil frisbees, you know, with an edge to them. They're scaling these LP records. It was a horrible night, and Vec comes out of the Mayo Clinic actually to see it, and he's at the end while this is going on. He's out of the field pleading with everybody to stop, and of course nobody's listening to him. And it's sort of a sad, you know, bookend for him. But he comes back as a sort of an elder statesman, and he's still one of the funniest guys. He, you know, right toward the end of his life, he's covering the World Series for USA Today, and he's running through the Baltimore airport, and as he collapses, he falls on the floor, and one of the women who work for the airlines comes running up to him and says, Mr. Vec, you're hurt. Can we get you a doctor? Can we get you a doctor? And Vec says, no, it's my wooden leg. Get me a carpenter. he was able to do, even at the end of his life, he was able to come up with lines. And it was the other thing you forget, we talk about all the things like race and the war and everything. The man is extraordinarily funny, extraordinarily witty. So a lot of his biography is just me passing along his lines, passing along the things he said, which is just very funny.
And it's also interesting that given, we talked earlier about how when in World War II, he enlisted in the Marines, and he said, what he wanted was to be in combat, to go and fight. And he did, and he had sustained this really serious injury to his foot that then caused him problems the rest of his life. That given that, he was very anti-gun and was very anti-war, and he apparently was a vocal opponent of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and he was also a declared socialist, which is another reason, one of the reasons that the predominantly Republican owners of the teams probably just took a look at the stances. Widow said one of his greatest disappointments in life that when the Nixon enemy list came out, he wasn't on the list. But his brother he never knew was killed in a gun accident at the age of 7. Beck goes in the Marines and says, I don't like guns, and then proves himself to be a sharpshooter, gets the highest possible rating, but becomes more and more involved in the consequence of the war has taken such a toll on him, such a toll on his friends, the guys who we fought with. It's just, he just becomes totally anti-war by the end of his life and totally committed to things like, you know, he does walk in Martin Luther King's funeral without crutches on a wooden leg and at great pain. And these are not just, these are his way of telling you who he really is. The other one is he's waiting in line. He loved John F. Kennedy. And when John F. Kennedy dies, he comes up with his nephew and his son, Mike. And it's a cold, lousy night, and they're way in the back of the line. And the Marines and the Secret Service keep coming up to him, Vec, and he's there on one leg. And they said, Mr. Vec, you know, you're a Marine veteran. You're a wounded Marine. Please come to the front of the line. The Marine guard actually tries to get him to come to the front of the line. He says, no, I'm not going to. He's all these people, this is their president, too. I don't deserve any special favors. So here's this man with one leg, with two little kids, and he refuses to go to the front of the line. I mean, that was the kind of person he was. He was just, even though he was born in a very, you know, high level of existence, a country club existence in Hinsdale, Illinois, you know, but he always acted this way. I mean, that was his way of dealing with the world.
We only have about a minute left, and I'm sorry we just got a call, and I don't think I'm going to have time to take it. Just can you talk for a minute? I wonder, he gave so much to the game, put so much into that. How was he as a family man? Did his children feel okay about him as a dad?
Yeah, his first marriage was a mess, and I talked to all the kids that were available, I mean, from the both marriages, mostly the second marriage, and they loved him. He was an extraordinary man. He spent a lot of time with his kids. Mike Vec is very much like him. Mike has owned several teams. When Mike took over the St. Paul Saints, he said he couldn't afford instant replay, so he had mimes and leotards do the instant replay. It was very Vecian the way to behave. I was with the family last week in Chicago, and his two daughters and his two sons, Gregory Vec and Lisa, so the family's very close, and his wife Mary Frances is still alive, and she's still married, I think, very absolutely very in love with the man. And so it was, for me, it was fun doing his biography. It was just, you know, I'd never done a biography before, and it was, I think I picked the right guy because he just had a fascinating life.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. If you want to read about the life of Bill Veeck, this is the place to go. And I think that people will, certainly if you're a baseball fan, you're going to like this book. But I don't think you have to be a baseball fan to find this guy fascinating and compelling. So the book you want to look at is Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. And his name, if you're not familiar with his name, it's spelled V-E-E-C-K, rhymes with wreck, as he titled his autobiography, Veeck, as in wreck. Our guest this morning, Paul Dixon, is the author of this book. He's written several books about baseball. And Mr. Dixon, thanks very much for talking with us.
This has just been a wonderful hour, so thank you
thank
so
you.
Much.
All right.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
Support for WILL is provided by Risk Management Commodities, presenting an Agricultural Outlook meeting at Trails Banquet Facility in Lafayette, Indiana, on Thursday, July 12th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tom Fritz from EFG in Chicago will be there. More information is available at 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. We're at mid-session for the Trading Pit. We have seen soybean futures in the nearby surging to a new all-time high. That's the July futures. Speculative and technical buying are featured in the market's bounce with bullish supply issues and new crop production uncertainties providing the spark to reignite bullish upward momentum. Analysts already expect greater demand for U.S. soybeans this year after drought shrank soy crops in key provinces of Brazil and Argentina are disappointing. And as we see, we have seen the July run on up. Meanwhile, over in the corn, It has not been a slacker either today. Corn futures, many of the contracts, the September and the 2 months beyond, have been limit up today at points during the trading session. They're also on the way up on the mounting worries that a Midwest drought is shrinking the country's corn crop significantly this afternoon. When NASS reports on its latest crop production report, many traders expecting another 5 to 8 to 9% decline in the good to excellent category on a nationwide average for the corn crop. And on a Wednesday, of course, we have